This is the RTE News at 1 with Brian Dobson. Good afternoon. The headlines this Monday lunchtime. Crime figures show that shops are becoming a significant target for thieves. A 25-year-old man has appeared in court, charged the murder of his father and the attempted murder of his mother in County Down last week. And a pay deal covering 385,000 public sector workers has been ratified by trade union leaders. The news in detail now with Brian Jennings.
The theft of goods from retailers is becoming more and more common. The trend is recorded in the annual crime figures released by the Central Statistics Office. Organised crime and fraud offences remain static, while the number of homicides was down. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
Retailers say there's been an epidemic of shoplifting over the past 2 years, a view reflected in the annual CSO crime figures released today. There were more than 74,000 theft offences last year, an annual increase of 12%, almost half of which was shoplifting. Robbery, extortion and blackmail offences also increased by 26%, driven mostly by a rise in blackmail or extortion and robbery from people. Burglaries also slightly increased, while serious and organised crime offences such as drugs and gun crime remained static. Homicide and related offences were down by 19%. Most of this decrease was due to a fall in the murder rate. Sexual offences were also down 11% to over 3,300 reported crimes, while public order and social code offences were down by 8%.
A 25-year-old man has appeared in court charged with the murder of his father and attempted murder of his mother in County Down last week. Colin McKee was remanded in custody until next month. Our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney.
Colin McKee of Canal Street in Newry appeared in Newry Magistrates Court this morning. He's charged with the murder of his father, 69-year-old Bobby McKee, and the attempted murder of his mother, Yvonne, at some point between Tuesday and Thursday last week. Mr. McKee had suffered severe head injuries and was declared dead when police arrived at their home in Kilkeel last Thursday. His wife had also suffered serious head injuries and has been treated in hospital. Colin McKee appeared in court briefly and spoke only to confirm that he understood the charges against him. A PSNI detective constable told the court she could connect him to those charges. The defendant was remanded in custody to appear in court again by video link next month. Vincent Kearney, RTÉ News, Newry Magistrates Court.
A 30-year-old man has appeared before Middleton District Court in County Cork, charged with the murder of a father of two. Dylan Scannell, with an address at number 9 O'Rahilly Street Cove, was charged with the murder of Ian Bateson at Newtown Cove, County Cork. Judge Colm Roberts remanded Mr. Scannell in custody to appear via video link before Mallow District Court tomorrow. Mr. Bateson was seriously injured in a car park in Cove last Friday week. He died in hospital 4 days later. A fourth Garda has appeared in court charged in connection with an anti-corruption investigation into the activities of a Garda unit based in Dublin. 43-year-old Robert Gorman, with an address in North Dublin, appeared before Dublin District Court this morning. Our court's reporter Vivian Traynor.
Robert Gorman is the fourth Garda and fifth person to appear in court in connection with an investigation by the Garda Anti-Corruption Unit into the activities of a particular Garda unit in Dublin. He faces three charges, including that on the 7th of September 2021, he entered as a trespasser to a flat in Mountjoy Square North in Dublin and committed theft. He's also charged with intending to pervert the course of justice by signing information used for a search warrant of the same premises and that he created three incidents on the Garda Pulse system. He was remanded on bail to the 17th of May next for service of a book of evidence. The court heard the DPP has directed trial on indictment, which means the case will be heard in a higher court. Three other Gardaí and a peace commissioner have already been before the court in the past 2 weeks on related charges. Vivian Traynor, RTÉ News at Dublin District Court.
Trade unions have formally ratified the latest public sector pay deal following a meeting of union leaders in Dublin today. Agreement was reached with the government in January on proposals that will provide for pay increases of 10.25% over 2.5 years. Our work and technology correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
Leaders of the 19 trade unions affiliated with the Public Services Committee of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions met today to give their final approval of the latest public sector pay deal. The biggest unions, including FORSA, SIPTU, the INTO and the INMO, also their members vote in favour of the agreement by big majorities. One union, the Veterinary Officers Association, voted against the deal, but the other 18 unions voted in favour, meaning the agreement has been officially ratified. It will benefit around 385,000 public servants, including nurses, doctors, Gardaí and teachers, with the first part of the agreement coming in the form of a 2.25% pay increase, backdated to the 1st of January. Union leaders today called on the government to pay that first increase as soon as possible. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, at the Irish Congress of Trade Unions.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Grant. Building a new home? Choose Grant's A++ rated Airona heat pump and Uflex underfloor heating. Visit grant.ie.
It'll be generally cloudy today with outbreaks of rain and drizzle, becoming lighter and patchier during the day. There'll be bright or sunny spells in the south this afternoon, but scattered showers too, some of which may be heavy. Highest temperatures will range from 7 to 10 degrees. Brian.
Thank you, Brian. Still to come this lunchtime, a man is charged with the murder in Cove last week of Ian Bates, and we'll hear from Middleton Court. A sharp rise in shoplifting last year, according to the latest CSO crime figures. Retailers respond. Limerick University writes off more than €5 million after overpaying for student housing. The chair of the Public Accounts Committee, Brian Stanley, will talk to us. Unions ratify that public sector pay deal. We'll take a closer look at who gets what and when. And staff in the Child and Family Agency Tustla raise concerns over emergency care for vulnerable children.
If you have a TV, you must have a TV licence. It's the law. Choose the convenient option and pay online, anytime at tvlicense.ie. Your TV licence made easier. Brought to you by the Government of Ireland.
I hear you some wiring needs a fixing, ma'am. The name's Buzz. On account of my work.
No chance.
Not all cowboys ride horses. All Safe Electric registered electrical contractors must give you a certificate of completion that shows their work meets approved standards. Find one nearby on safeelectric.ie.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. A 30-year-old man has appeared in court charged with the murder of father of two, Ian Bateson, in Cove. Dylan Scall was brought before a special sitting of the District Court in Middleton in Cork this morning. We can talk now to our reporter Jenny O'Sullivan, who was in court. So what happened this morning, Jenny? Oh, I'm sorry, we've just lost our link to Jenny. We will return to that. As you've been hearing, a growing number of robberies from shops is driving a significant increase in theft offences, according to official statistics. The Central Statistics Office crime figures show almost half of the 74,000 thefts and related offences last year related to thefts from shops. The group representing newsagents say that retail continues to be an incredibly challenging environment. At a security forum last week, Gardaí said that assaults associated with shoplifting and people driving off without paying for fuel are escalating issues. Well, let's talk to Vincent Jennings, who's Chief Executive of the Convenience Stores and Newsagents Association. Vincent Jennings, you're very welcome to the programme and thanks for speaking to us today. These figures which we have from the CSO, I suspect they confirm a trend which has been very evident to you and your members for some time.
That's right. Thank you for your interest, Ryan. Yeah, no, it has. And the statistics are not lying. There has been an increase, and it's a growing increase from the four-year period, 2019 through 2023. We've had a 52% increase in reported incidents of theft from supermarkets and convenience stores. And that was 16% of an increase last year alone. So 51% of all reported thefts are from our sector. I mean, that's a frightening thing, but it's not just the thefts, though they are very concerning. It is the associated incidents that go along with it. It is the assaults, it is the assaults causing harm, it's the drunkenness, it's the public order offences. It's the misogynistic and hateful comments that are being made to our staff. All of those are real concerns to us.
Before we talk a bit more about that, you also at this forum last week, I think, were presented with or were able to present some information on what's been stolen, what's been targeted.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's primarily, I mean, what you're looking at is food, is grocery, is liquor, is healthcare, is cosmetics. I mean, 54% of all of the items stolen come within the first range, the food, the grocery and the liquor. And that's, you know, I mean, that's, you're talking about probably 3 in 4 products are listed there, when you include the healthcare and the cosmetics. So that's what's being taken. And you're finding a significant amount of products that are being stolen for resale. So you have, dishwasher pods and the like being stolen. You have a lot of stuff that certainly isn't. I mean, some people would suggest that it is the cost of living that is bringing problems about. And no doubt that there are problems from the cost of living, but some of this is just pure and utter theft for financial purposes.
And the parts of the country that have seen the biggest increases in these thefts, it's not actually Dublin city centre, which might surprise some people in terms of what's been
happening. Yeah, absolutely.
Been here in
sure. I mean, so increases last year were limited to 2% in Dublin. But in the east, there's Garda divisions are 4 of them. There's 23% of an increase. In the northwest, 31% of an increase. And the southern regions, 14%. So that is an enormous variation between 2% and 31%.
You mentioned the situation that many staff are left in. What happens when staff see somebody stealing from the premises? What can they do? And what do they potentially face if they try to take action to stop the theft?
Well, that's a matter for whatever the policy is in the store. But ordinarily, for the safety of the staff member, it would be considered prudent not to confront them, because it has been too frequently people have become violent and abusive once they're confronted. So that then leads to really a lawless situation developing.
And are stores looking increasingly at getting their own security on the premises?
Well, that does happen in some instances, most certainly. But, I mean, we are, and you opened up by saying how challenging we were living in our challenging times and competitive times. Our margins are so low that actually costs like that dip into making you actually unsustainable and unviable if you're going to do that on a very regular basis. It's something, I mean, we do have great faith in the Gardaí, and most certainly the increase that there has been in 999 calls is as a result of a full belief that the quicker that they get that information, the quicker the people can be apprehended. But Brian, if there's a number of things that I could say, I think we really have a need to adopt a zero tolerance policy. I think that we really should be allowed to have the Gardaí share images of convicted shoplifters, and most certainly one of the things that could help is for a policy from the guards that they would return stolen property promptly.
Vincent Jennings, Chief Executive of the Convenience Stores and News Agents Association, thanks for talking to us. Moscow has refused to comment on the Islamic State group's claim that it was behind the deadliest attack in Russia in 2 decades as rescuers search for bodies amid the rubble of the concert hall. At least 137 people, including 3 children, were killed on Friday evening when gunmen entered the Crocus City Hall and then set fire to the building in the most fatal attack in Europe to have been claimed by Islamic State jihadists. Let's talk to Dr. Jenny Matthews, who's Senior Lecturer in International Politics at Aberystwyth University. Dr. Malin, thank you for taking our call this lunchtime. Islamic State have claimed responsibility for this, although it seems that the Kremlin is continuing to try to point the finger of blame at Ukraine.
That's right. It is, I think, much more comfortable, much more convenient for Putin and other Russian officials to try and find a way to implicate Ukraine and, by extension, implicate the West in this terrorist attack, rather than sort of looking for the obvious answer, which is, you know, someone has claimed responsibility for it. But nevertheless, it would be much more convenient and more comforting to think for Putin to think that this is something else that he can blame on Ukraine.
There was a warning some weeks ago from the United States that ISIS may be planning an attack on Russia. To what extent is it likely to be seen in Russia as a very major failing by the Kremlin and by the security services?
Well, I think this is the big question, is how will Russians interpret what has happened? Because on the one hand, Putin has been in power, you know, one way and another since the end of 1999, and he's put a lot of the state's resources into the security services, and he has claimed that he is very tough on, you know, security breaches, he's very tough on terrorism. But on the other hand, of course, you know, every time that there is a security breach, every time there is a terrorist attack, and there have been many during his time as president, you know, questions should be raised about, well, is this a really good investment? Is this effective? You know, certainly the security services in Russia are good at cracking down on opposition figures. They're good at arresting people who are innocently and peacefully protesting, but maybe they're not quite so good at preventing and dealing with actual threats to Russia's security.
In fact, in the past, we've seen Putin use similar attacks to clamp down on opposition, to strengthen his hold on power and to centralize more power.
Absolutely. So if we think, for example, about 2004, the hostage taking in the school in Beslan, which was a terrible disaster and you know, many, more than 100 people were killed, many of them children. After that, Putin introduced new changes to how regional governors would be chosen, no longer elected directly, but you know, appointed by the Kremlin. So he really does take opportunities to try and increase central power, but also to advance agendas that he already has in play.
Does this attack indicate that ISIS now is a renewed threat to not just to Russia, but to countries around the world?
Well, I think it depends on which branch of ISIS we're talking about, because there are different branches and they do have different targets, different capabilities and so on. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, ISIS, the threat from ISIS isn't something that we can safely say is in the past. They still exist. They still have their own agendas. They have their own ideologies. They have capabilities. I'm certain that it's not a threat that the world's intelligence services are taking lightly.
And how much a threat does Islamic extremism pose to Russia? Where are the pressure points? Where are the dangers?
Well, I think there's a lot of anger against Russia for its actions in Syria, propping up the Assad regime for its actions in wars in Chechnya, and generally supporting some really brutal treatment of Chechen people. So there are good reasons that they have, that they believe, to oppose Russia. And certainly they seem to be recruiting quite heavily from Central Asian states. Many of the people from those states have been working abroad in Russia, you know, to send money back and have found themselves on the receiving end of, you know, quite a lot of racism and brutality. So, you know, there are some reasons why the message of Islamic State does resonate with people in that region.
Dr. Jenny Mathers from the University of Aberystwyth, thanks very much for talking to us. Now back to that court appearance in Middleton this morning of a 30-year-old man charged with the murder of father of two, Ian Bateson, in Cove. Dylan Scannell was brought before a special sitting of the district court in Middleton a little earlier, and we do now have a connection to Jenny O'Sullivan, who was in court. So what transpired this morning, Jenny?
Well, you'll recall that Ian Bateson was attacked in the car park of the Eurospar shopping centre on the Newtown Road in Cove on Saturday evening, the 16th of March. And despite the efforts of passerbys and the emergency services, the father of two young children and chef, he died 3 days later at Cork University Hospital. Well, this morning, 30-year-old Dylan Scannell, with an address in the town, it's at number 9 O'Rahilly Street in Cove, was brought before a special sitting of the district court in Middleton. He'd been arrested for questioning last Friday in County Waterford by Gardaí investigating the murder of Mr. Bateson. Now, the court heard from Detective Sergeant Juror Shocknessy, who gave evidence of arresting Mr. Scannell yesterday, and said he made no reply when charged and cautioned with the murder of the 33-year-old. Superintendent Adrian Gamble told Judge Colin Roberts that the state's application was to remand Mr. Scannell in custody, that he appear again before the district court tomorrow. Mr. Scannell's solicitor, Ken Murphy, told the judge that there wouldn't be any application today for bail given the charge, but said he was applying for free legal aid for his client. The application for free legal aid was granted by Judge Roberts, and he then remanded the 30-year-old in custody to appear again in the district court in Mallow tomorrow via video link from prison. The hearing lasted less than 2 minutes, Brian.
Jenny O'Sullivan in Middleton, thanks for that. Children in special emergency care arrangements are contracting scabies and living in rooms with bed bugs, according to internal child and family agency TUSLA documents seen by the Irish Times. There are also issues with overcrowding and concerns over the risk of peer-to-peer abuse due to children sharing bedrooms. 178 children are currently being accommodated in unregulated emergency accommodation. We've been speaking to Jack Power, journalist with the Irish Times, about the story.
So there's around 170 children placed in these emergency placements, which are known as special emergency arrangements. You know, generally that could be cases where a child might have been taken into state care and been in a regulated care home and that placement is broken down, or they could be with a foster carer and that placement for whatever reason is broken down, and then a new placement has to be found. But one of the big problems is there's a serious lack of regulated standard accommodation. So what we've seen is increasingly TUSLA is relying on this emergency sector. And also a lot of these children, I think nearly two thirds of them, are what are called unaccompanied minors. So that's effectively child asylum seekers under the age of 18 that have come into the country without a guardian, that TUSLA also has to find a place for. Often in these situations, children will be placed in private rental accommodation, you know, a house rented somewhere with staff from private companies running the placement.
And it's a sector which is pretty well unregulated.
Yeah, so this is unregulated accommodation. This is separate to, you know, kind of a standard group care home that might have between one and four children in state care in it. You know, there was a situation where there was only a handful of these emergency placements a few years ago, and now, as I said, we're seeing around 170 children placed in these emergency arrangements.
So what then, Jack, do these leaked documents reveal about the conditions that these children are being kept in?
So we got hold of a large leak of documents, which included internal TUSLA emails, briefings, audit and inspection reports, and even confidential case notes from social workers. And what a lot of it highlights is serious internal concerns within TUSLA about the standard of accommodation provided and some of the setups. You know, one thing that came through very clearly was the fact that, and this doesn't happen in regulated places, but it's happening in these emergency places, the children who aren't related often have to share rooms with each other. And what the documents warned was, you know, this could lead to potential cases of, you know, one child sexually abusing another child, both while they're in the care of the state. And other issues were the fact that, you know, this accommodation doesn't provide any real therapeutic supports. It, you know, using the language provided by one of the documents I saw, it said it amounted to containment of a child only. And so what it shows is really that even inside TUSLA, there's serious, serious worry about, I suppose, the standard of the accommodation that we're putting children into in these situations.
So clearly concerns within TUSLA on the evidence of these documents, Jack, but what is TUSLA saying publicly about this? What's their response?
So TUSLA have said that, you know, they're attempting to reduce the number of children placed in these emergency arrangements. You know, in respect to that, we've kind of only seen them go in one direction. We've only seen them, you know, put more children into these placements, you know, compared to this time last year. You know, TUSLA have also said they're doing more to try and increase the oversight of these arrangements and the oversight of the companies running these accommodation placements for children in care. TUSLA said in response to queries from myself that, you know, they weren't commenting on individual cases. you know, based on some of the documentation that we got, but that they were trying to address this, I suppose, problem of children being placed in these unsuitable and inappropriate accommodation setups. They were trying to address that as a matter of priority, you know, at the highest levels within the agency.
The main concern here clearly is child welfare, but there's also the financial aspect of this. As you said, this is a service which is costing upwards of 70 million euro a year. So the use of public funds is also an issue.
Yeah, I mean, these individual accommodation arrangements, you know, just to cater for one child in an emergency placement per year can cost up to 1 million, you know, just for that child. So we've seen the amount TUSLA has been spending in this emergency sector balloon in the last 3 years to, as you said, last year, it topped 70 million within just that year. So there's also a serious kind of cost issue, which based on the fact that these arrangements are much more expensive to keep children in compared to, you know, placing a child with a foster carer or in a regulated group care home run by TUSLA or a private provider.
That's Jack Power of the Irish Times speaking to me earlier. The University of Limerick has confirmed it lost 5.2 million euro after paying an inflated price last year for 20 houses to be used to accommodate students. UL President Kirsten May said independent valuations have confirmed that the university paid, quote, significantly above market price for the properties in Ray Bogue near the university. In a letter sent to students and staff, she said this is an issue of major concern for the university in terms of management, governance and reputation. The Doyle Public Accounts Committee has been examining financial issues at UL in recent years, including paying above market price for another property deal in Limerick City. Representatives from the university are due before the committee in 2 weeks' time. The chair of the PAC, Brian Stanley, is on the line now. Deputy Stanley, thanks for taking our call. Welcome to the News at One. This statement from the president of UL confirming an impairment of 5.2 million as a result of this transaction. What's your response?
Good afternoon, Brian, and good afternoon to your listeners. Well, we have a situation here where the final bill for this will run to about 12.5 million or in excess of that, with each property coming in the region of 629,000 when you take everything in stamp duty and all payments in. I have one here in front of me from a Shirley Fitzgerald for an advertisement in the same estate for 255,000. And this is public money, mainly, it's students' money. And we have a situation here where UL, University of Limerick, who have been in before the Public Accounts Committee on a number of occasions, not least in relation to the purchase of a Dunn store site that was valued at 3 million, which they finished up paying 8.3 million for, and other matters like that. It's a case of here you go again. This matter has arisen, and we're bringing them before the Public Accounts Committee on the 11th of April to deal with these issues. I note the letter from the president out to the to staff in the facility, but you know here is a public university going out and purchasing at more than double the price, and not just that, they bought properties which are in a housing estate. Which will need, as I understand it, will need some adoption because there are 480 students, four per house. So it will have to be some adaptation carried out to make it suitable for individual units. There's that cost. And we're facing a situation where the actual cost per unit may go beyond what I've just said of the 620 to 630,000. And what we need to know is here is that I would have thought that the lessons were learned in relation to, you know, following the Dunn store site, which to purchase in the city at more than double the valuation at the time. But here you are again with public money you have the same mistake being repeated again.
Presumably one of the questions is, was there a valuation carried out for the university of these properties?
Well, what I want to know is this. I do know from when we've had them in the past that they would always say that they had professional assistance and professional advice, and they'll have consultants sometimes buying for them, and they have internal head of management or property management or estate management. And you know what professional valuations did they get? Because if they had to go onto daft.ie, if they had to go onto the internet for 5 minutes, they would have seen what was available. And did they do comparisons with other homes in that area which, by the way, my information is that this site at Rabaul is actually 3 kilometres from the from the UL. And in their letter, the state, reading their letter to the staff, you think that's beside it.
Yeah.
But did they factor in the extra costs, Brian, such as the stamp duty, such as any adaptation works that's to be carried out?
Yeah.
And why wasn't the lessons of the Dunstore site, why was that ignored?
The governing body has, and this letter reminds students and staff of this, in December approved a full review as described of the acquisition of these houses. When that's complete, they say, the governing body will determine the next steps, which she, as president of the university, says she will implement. Is that an adequate response to this?
No, it's not, because I know in the past that the governing body have played a very minor role, because in relation to the Dunn site, it was brought in at the end of a meeting back a number of years ago and kind of rushed through it, and the impression was given that there was good valuations done and sound professional advice. But we know that wasn't the case. And what we want to know in this case, was this brought to the governing authority before the purchase of these houses, which will finish up with a price tag, with a final price tag of, it could be in excess of 630,000 each. What involvement had the governing authority? Was it brought before a full meeting? Was there a full account given? Was there valuations given in terms of comparable properties? And if the decision was taken? And what I want to know is, as well, is who exactly, in terms of head of estates or head of property management at university, or external consultants that gave advice here, who exactly were they?
All right.
And what happened here that if somebody's going out to buy a house, if some of your listeners are going out to buy a house, I mean, the first thing they will do, they will go onto the internet or they'll go to a local estate agent and they'll see what else is for sale in that area and they'll make a comparison with the price.
All right.
But here we have a public body with professional people at hand to them to go out and pay more than double the valuation. I mean, this is incredible stuff.
Well, plenty of questions, no doubt, for the university representatives when they appear before you in a couple of weeks' time. Brian Stanley, thanks very much indeed for that. Back with more after this short break.
Join the RTE Concert Orchestra to celebrate the music of 28-time Grammy-winning songwriter, producer and composer Quincy Jones. A stellar lineup of vocalists showcase the best of Quincy Jones' work, including the music of Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Peggy Lee, Aretha Franklin, Michael Jackson, Diana Ross and more. Thursday, April 18th, National Concert Hall, Dublin. The music of Quincy Jones with the RTE Concert Orchestra. See rte.ie/co for more.
Hello, I'm Caoimhe de Barra from Throcra, urging you to return your Throcra Box donation. For families in Malawi whose lives have been devastated by climate change, your support means access to clean, safe water and the tools they need to cope with the ongoing cycle of floods and drought. Your help can make all the difference, because it's not just a box, it's a lifeline. Please visit throcra.org or call 1-800-408-408. Throcra. Together for a just world.
RTE Radio 1.
Arcade Fire. Live in concert. Plus Echo and the Bunnymen. Malahide Castle, July 7th. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster.ie. Subject to license. Experience the band perform their debut album, Funeral, in its entirety. Plus much more. Arcade Fire. Tickets available now.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. A second Connemara-based county councillor has left Fianna Fáil and will run as an independent candidate in the local elections. Noel Thomas said the party had become detached from the people and that it bore little resemblance to the organisation he joined 3 decades ago. Last week, another councillor, Seamus Walsh, announced he too is leaving Fianna Fáil and will contest the June election under the Independent Ireland banner. Both elected representatives were critical of government plans to house asylum seekers in a former hotel in their area late last year. Well, Councillor Noel Thomas is on the line now. A very good afternoon to you and welcome to the News of One, Councillor.
Good afternoon, Brian.
As I was saying, you were involved in that protest against the use of the hotel at Ross Cahill near Uachtarard for asylum seekers. And I think at the time, comments you made led the Fianna Fáil organisation to say that its Rules and Procedures Committee would examine what you had to say. Now, is it as a result of that disciplinary process that you're making this announcement today?
Well, it is partly. I suppose, look at when you said it yourself there at the beginning, you said that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I think that the main political parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin included, and the Green Party, have seemed to have become very detached from the ordinary person, as far as I'm concerned. And I suppose that's been eaten away at me for some time. And I suppose I was holding on all the time in the hope that, that some members of the Dáil would actually, you know, kick back against the leadership that was there and maybe try and get things to change. But anyway, that never happened. So we'll just go back to what you were talking about there now, the incident in the hotel. And like, what happened in that, right? First of all, nobody from Fianna Fáil had the respect or anything to get in touch with me to inform me that any disciplinary procedures were being taken against me. The only place I was hearing this was on the airwaves and the media shows, different shows around the country. Mm-hmm. And then finally, on the 22nd of December, they finally sent me an email to inform me that they were starting some disciplinary procedures in relation to it. So what they'd done, they were asking me to answer some questions. Now, kind of strange enough questions as far as I was concerned. Like, they asked me, first of all, do I condemn totally the actions of the burning of the building, something that I had condemned many time on media. And they also asked me if I was actually present at the blockade as well. Now, and one of the most things that caught my attention on this email then was they said that some of your public comments have caused considerable controversy. Now, I asked them to explain to me very clearly what those comments were that I made and what controversy they had caused. Now, if somebody is going to investigate me for any reason at all, then they should be able to explain to me what they're investigating me for. Well, but to this date, nobody from Fianna Fáil has come back to explain those questions to me.
What you did say at the time was that some people might be afraid that there could be antisocial behaviour coming from the group of young men who were being isolated in an area like this, to use your words. You were asked whether Ireland should continue to accept people seeking asylum, you said, no, we shouldn't, because the inn is full. Do you regret those comments now?
No, not at all. And when people ask me what the people in the area were, what their concerns were, people had come to me and told me that they were afraid in relation to what was happening there. And nobody can tell me that my constituents are not entitled to give their opinions or give their concerns. Mm-hmm. Like, that's my job as an elected representative, is to represent those people. I was doing in that case.
Well, a party spokesperson.
When it came to this quote, the famous quote about the inn being full, like, you see, that was just completely taken out of context as being some kind of racist remark or whatever. But in actual fact, by what we had done, we had filled all the accommodation in our country by reckless open border policies. And they'll keep telling us we haven't had open border policies, but we had. We put out an invite to people to come here because the social welfare were very high. That
comment would be strongly contested by anybody in government, and I think very many people in opposition as well, that we have an open border policy. It's a rules-based system, Councillor, as we're repeatedly reminded.
What you've got to understand here is that what we have done by the measures we took that time when the Ukrainian war started is that we have filled all our accommodation, and let's call a spade and be very honest about it. I'm also chairperson of the LCDC here in Galway County Council. I'm very aware of what's going on here. So what we've done, we've filled most of our accommodation with people who mostly were not fleeing war, to be very honest about it.
But their country,
people who were coming,
their country was
but
in...
Their,
just, well, no, let me, sorry, no, no, as no, a this, matter of fact, but, sorry, as a matter of fact, their country was invaded by Russia. They were at war.
100%. No, but what we have done, Brian, is we have left ourselves in a position now for the genuine people who need our help. And there's lots of genuine people still that need our help from Ukraine as well, that want to come here. We've no place to put them. You see it yourself there the other day, the pictures on the news.
One of the reasons why there's a shortage of accommodation is because locations like the hotel in Uachtaráid are set on fire, and if they're not that, they're blockaded, and there is local resistance to receiving people in their communities.
No, you see, I completely disagree with you on that. The reason that we have no accommodation for people who need accommodation in this country is because of our disastrous manner in which we dealt with all the situation from day one. As I said to you, we have flooded all the accommodation we have with people who may not be requiring that accommodation, to be very honest about it.
Sorry, councillor. We're talking about individuals here, many of whom are fleeing desperate situations, and to describe them as flooding the country is really feeding a lot of that fear, isn't it?
No, it's not, because Brian, I've already said it now two times to you here, that the people who need our help, we need to help them. And I openly support all of that myself. But I can see, like, there's no point pretending here. But
there were people who who were being brought into Roscahl who needed help, who needed a place to stay, and they were turned away.
Well, we don't know who they were that were bringing into Roscahl, to be very honest with you. We don't know.
They were international protection applicants.
Either way, look, no matter what way you want to look at this. I mean, what they were doing in that situation, again, they were going cramming four people per room at least. Now, but who in their right mind would want to live in those kind of conditions anyway?
Well,
and out in a very remote area.
Is it better that they're in a tent on the street?
Well, no. You see, we need to be handling this, as I said, in a responsible manner. Government need to step in here and do it properly, so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we've got people left sleeping on our streets.
All right. Councillor Noel Thomas, thanks very much for talking to us on the programme. Trade unions have formally ratified the latest public sector pay deal following a meeting of union leaders in Dublin today. Agreement was reached with the government in January on proposals that will provide for pay increases of 10.25% over 2.5 years. The Secretary General of the Forsa Union, Kevin Callanan, welcomed ratification but called on the government to address discrepancies in pay for new entrants into the public service.
I would say the government can unilaterally solve one of those problems, because they can't expect people who work already in the public service to pay for the problem of pay for new entrants. And they need to reverse the decision that was made by the government in 2011 to introduce lower rates of pay for new entrants. That should be done immediately.
Let's talk to our work and technology correspondent, Brian O'Donovan. Brian, the 10.25% over 2.5 years, how's all this going to be work? When's the money going to be paid?
Well, the first instalment of this pay deal, Brian, will come in the form of a 2.25% pay increase backdated to the 1st of January. Now, the big question on, I'm sure, the lips of all the public sector workers listening to this today is, well, when exactly is that first increase, that first 2.25% going to take effect? The union leaders we were speaking to here today at the Irish Congress of Trade Unions very much saying that this should happen as soon as possible. They said, look, yes, we've ratified the deal today, but we very much flagged it with the government that it would be ratified, it would be approved, and they're hoping that things have been put in train to ensure that this money lands in people's bank accounts as soon as possible. As she left the talks earlier, Philney Hay of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation said that pay increase should land immediately. She's calling it for it to happen in the next round of pay, which will be happening in the coming weeks. But look, there's a bit of a process involved here. Right now, the unions will formally inform the government that they have ratified this pay deal. Then the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform will communicate that to all the various different government departments that employ the country's public sector workers, and then gradually, bit by bit, over the coming weeks, we will see those first pay increases take effect, the first in a series of increases that will run between now and June 2026.
Brian O'Donovan, thanks very much for that.
Sport on RTE Radio 1.
And it's good afternoon to Siobhan Madigan. Siobhan.
Brian, thank you. Good afternoon. The Republic of Ireland soccer squad will train once again today under the watchful eye of their interim manager, John O'Shea. He'll take charge for the second and potentially final time tomorrow evening when the Republic hosts Switzerland at the Aviva Stadium in an international friendly. Under 21 international captain Joe Hodge and attacking option Andrew Moran have both joined the squad in advance of the fixture. And radio coverage tomorrow evening will be available over on RTE 2FM with kickoff at the Aviva at 7:45. The GAA have confirmed the date and venue for this year's Allianz League Hurling Division 1 final today. Clare and Kilkenny will face off on Saturday, April the 6th at FBD Semple Stadium in Thurles. Throw-in will be at 7:15pm. It'll be a first league final meeting of the side since way back in 2005. All four football divisional finals take place at Croke Park next weekend, starting out with Leitrim and Laois on Saturday.